Frankly, I believe we got a little ahead of ourselves in some of these longer-term plays, and I want to moderate our investment pace here.
Shell says it won't drill exploratory wells in the Arctic Ocean this summer. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 30th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Democrats in the legislature introduce a bill to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act.
Expanding Medicaid makes sense both financially and morally.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the 2014 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Shell announced today that it has called off its plan to do exploratory oil and gas drilling in Arctic waters off Alaska this year, and what it will do in future years is not clear. The company's new CEO, Ben Van Beurden, pointed directly to a recent federal appeals court ruling that casts doubt over the federal oil and gas lease sales in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas.
We are frustrated by the recent decision by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in what is a six-year-old lawsuit against the government. And the obstacles that were introduced by that decision simply make it impossible to justify the commitments of cost, equipment, and people that are needed to drill safely in Alaska this year. So we have to wait for the courts and the U.S. administration to resolve this legal issue. And given all of this, we will not drill in Alaska in 2014. And we are reviewing our options here.
The ruling by a panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals came in a lawsuit filed by environmental groups and the native village of Point Hope that claimed federal authorities underestimated the amount of oil and gas exploration and development activity the sales would generate and the impacts that would result from those activities. Until now, Shell has been leading that industry push, but its exploration ventures in 2012 ran into problems, including a drilling rig that went adrift and grounded south of Kodiak. Van Beurden took the helm of Shell a month ago. Today, he announced the figures on its financial performance for the past year, and they were not pretty. Profits were down 71% from the year before. He said the company has, quote, lost momentum, and he's setting a new course.
Frankly, I believe we got a little ahead of ourselves in some of these longer-term plays, and I want to moderate our investment pace here.
Late last year, ConocoPhillips, the other company that had plans to drill in Chukchi this year, quietly shelved its plans as well. At least one Alaska community was banking on Shell's presence and business this summer. Onalaska was going to play host to half a dozen drilling and support vessels and dozens of crew members. Then a Shell Alaska executive called Onalaska Mayor Shirley Marquardt at home last night. He broke the news that the company was canceling its Arctic plans.
Just so it wouldn't be caught off guard, and we've worked very well together over the last several years, so I appreciated that.
Shell had booked up more than half the available rooms at the Grand Aleutian Hotel leading up to the start of their drilling season in the Arctic. Hotel managers say they were in touch with Shell personnel as recently as Tuesday to confirm those reservations. Just 2 weeks ago, a Shell crew was at the hotel to meet with local tugboat captains, shipping company representatives, Onalaska's ports director, and marine pilot Dave Lund. Lund says they figured out where to place Shell's two drilling rigs and what kind of anchors they would need to withstand storms.
All the main players that were going to be involved in this, they were all out here. So it was a very successful meeting.
A week later, a federal appeals court ruled that Shell's oil leases are faulty because of bad scoping work in the Arctic. That was the final straw for any exploration work this summer. A campaign by Senator Lisa Murkowski to lift the decades-old ban on crude oil exports got its first hearing in Washington today. It's been 25 years since Congress has formally considered the ban it adopted during the Arab oil embargo. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the recent energy boom in the lower 48 is triggering new debates.
To some people, it still sounds crazy. Why consider selling American crude overseas when the U.S. still imports 40% of its oil from other countries? And then there's the question of the impact on consumer prices. Chairman of the Senate Energy Committee, Ron Wyden of Oregon, says that's his focus.
American families and American businesses deserve to know what exports would mean for their specific needs when they fill up at the pump or get their delivery of heating oil.
The witnesses at the hearing spoke from their own economic corners. Harold Hamm, CEO of Continental Resources, the largest leaseholder in North Dakota's Bakken play, says the ban gives undue advantage to U.S. refineries. The export ban only covers raw materials, so the refiners can sell their fuel overseas, but as he put it, producers like him are stuck being their milk cows. A Delta Airlines executive, on the other hand, says allowing crude exports will force the price up to whatever OPEC wants it to be, and American consumers will have to pay more for airline tickets and everything else. An academic from the University of California, Davis, says it's not so simple. Amy Myers Jaffe says U.S. petroleum is already on the world market in the refined products we export.
So what we're really discussing is, number one, what is the best way to organize free markets and to eliminate distortions, and who gets the profit from the exports?
With the ban in place, it's the refiners. Without the ban, producers get in on it. Jaffe notes another market wrinkle. The Bakken boom produces light oil, but refineries are set up to process particular grades. So she says America will always have to import heavy crude,
because there's just going to be some refineries that already exist in the Gulf Coast that have certain configurations, and there's just only so much light crude they can put through the system.
Murkowski says it's good for policymakers to ask questions and ponder the issue. She figures it will take a lot more dialogue before Congress members and their constituents feel comfortable with lifting the ban. But she also says we're running out of time.
We get to a point where we're going to have a mismatch between what we are producing domestically and our ability to meet the needs, the capacity within our refineries.
Murkowski says without exports, we may reach the point of oversupply in just 2 years. After the hearing, Murkowski said Alaskans have a special reason to be concerned, because North Slope Oil may have to compete for West Coast refinery space.
I think as Alaskans, we need to appreciate we have enjoyed higher prices for our crude because it has been in high demand, particularly in California. But if California is now going to be able to meet this demand because of oil coming from other parts of the lower 48, that price is going to go down. Our margins are going to be less for Alaska.
She says she plans to eventually draft an export bill and press her case to the administration. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
State Department of Transportation crews will be working for days to get the Richardson Highway completely opened. Hannah Blankenship is a spokeswoman for the DOT's northern region. She says the majority of the backed up water from the low river has receded back to within the river's banks.
However, there still some debris and ice left over from where the water was, and that is what our crews are going to be working on removing in the next few days.
Blankenship says they are still evaluating the snowpack, and it's unclear what kind of damage may have occurred to the roadway. She says they don't have a timeline for reopening the highway because stability is still an issue. Links to updates are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the Army practices launching unmanned aircraft systems.
What you got to see here today was actually probably one of the smoothest takeoffs I've seen, probably ever.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Soldiers from the 425th Brigade Special Troops Battalion conducted an Unmanned Aircraft System, or UAS, training flight this morning in the skies over Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. APRN's Josh Edge has more.
With about a 14-foot wingspan, the Shadow stands around knee-high. A rear-facing motor is mounted on the back of the fuselage, trailed by an inverted V-shaped tail section a few feet behind. On the front half of the aircraft, El Super Bisto 2 is hand-lettered onto the side, with a painted set of grinning teeth adorning the nose. Once it's secured in a catapult mounted on a trailer, the crew goes through its pre-flight checklist, ensuring everything is in order for takeoff. Then they walk a safe distance away and await a launch order.
What you got to see here today was actually probably one of the smoothest takeoffs I've seen, probably ever.
That's Staff Sergeant Brandon Byers. He helps oversee the maintenance section, which does everything from maintaining the aircraft to launching it. He says the Shadow can stay airborne for up to around 6 hours in its current configuration. If the crew opts to use the larger 20-foot wings, it can stay aloft for up to 9 hours. Byers says the operators work off a constant video feed from the UAS. The camera can pick up heat signatures and see impressions in the ground that train crews are able to identify.
They're able to distinguish the different features and the marks on the ground through that payload, which is pretty amazing. Payload, it's actually pretty great footage for what it is, but it's not spot on. You're not going to pick out, decipher somebody's facial features on it or anything like that.
The Shadow is also equipped with a laser designator to paint targets for other aircraft.
Say we're spotting somebody in place in an IED. You know, we call it in. They say, hey, we're sending an Apache on it, you know. If we can't get coordinates or something like that, laser designate the area, their missiles sink onto that, and problem solved.
Though painting targets and looking at vehicle track marks in the dirt are a part of what the aircraft can do, Chief Warrant Officer 3 George Summers says that's not its entire mission.
What this system is designed to do is to provide ISR, that's intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. And what that means is, we're out there answering questions for battlefield commanders. So if I'm an infantry commander, I don't want to waste my time sending my troops over here in the wrong direction. So his questions are enemy course of action, enemy capabilities, troop size, troop movement. And we get out there in front of him and try to locate those answers for him.
This particular flight was conducted to maintain the proficiency and readiness of the unit. Summers says there are several factors that need to fall into place to launch one of their UASs, including weather.
So we can't fly when it's raining, we can't fly when it's too cold, we can't fly in icing conditions or when it's too windy. So normal things that would ground an aircraft is going to ground us as well.
When the weather cooperates, Summers says they have to coordinate with the FAA, Alaska Air Traffic Control, the Air Force, Army, and Army National Guard before the aircraft can take off. During the training flights, the UAS is expected to remain in military-restricted airspace, but in the event it slips out of the designated area, precautions are taken to ensure the aircraft still operates safely.
There is a chance that the aircraft could enter national airspace, so we take every precaution that it would, and we pretend that it's going to, just in case that it would. It's not accidentally, it's planned, everyone's aware. We've cleared airspace in 3 different ways, visually, with tower, and with radar.
So far, UAS operations from JBAIR have not strayed from military airspace. This is the second time a Shadow has been launched from JBAIR. The first was in November. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Shell may be abandoning their plans for drilling in Alaska's Arctic waters in 2014, but vessel traffic, tourism, and other activity will continue to advance. As part of our ongoing look at future plans for port development and military oversight of Arctic safety and security, I recently spoke with Dr. Daniel Chu, the Undersecretary for Strategy at the Department of Defense. Chu says the Pentagon expects large increases in defense activity is likely decades out. But he says DOD is closely following climate science to ensure they have the lead time to adjust if necessary.
So we are doing that, and we're doing that through a process that we have internal to the Department of Defense that generates, for example, our requirements and our budgetary outlooks. And we're doing that in close conjunction in this case with Northern Command. They have been named the Arctic Capability Advocate. They will be the lead in determining, as conditions change, should we need to change the way we plan for the Arctic.
There's, as you're well aware, there's a lot of political jockeying going on regarding Arctic resources right now. Canada is building up their Arctic military. Russia and Canada are staking overlapping claims in the Arctic. How do you see this unfolding over the next decade? And what is the U.S. military's role in ensuring there's no escalation of tensions over territory and sovereignty?
On the capabilities piece, Canada, of course, is paying a lot of attention to the Arctic, and we understand that. But as I understand it, they are also thinking very hard about how to invest those resources over time. And I think they would, as we do, try to tie that as much to conditions as possible. And by that, I don't just mean environmental conditions. I do mean the conditions that you were alluding to about the competing claims, the political military, so to speak, conditions in the region. So in the meantime, we do think it's absolutely critical to manage the resolution of any competing claims in the Arctic. These are largely not defense issues. This is largely about using existing mechanisms to resolve these disputes. They are in place, and to a large extent, those with competing claims are adherents to those processes, and we strongly encourage that.
Conditions are changing rapidly in the Arctic, and there's growing mm-hmm. international interest.
Mm-hmm.
It takes at least a decade. If Congress gave the green light today for funding for icebreakers, for an Arctic port, we're still at least a decade away from having that work done. Security is in a large degree unmonitored in this region. How concerning is that?
So 2 points that are important. One is the lead time, and we're very cognizant of that, both because of the types of capabilities we're talking about. For example, I know a lot of folks are focused on the icebreaker question, or because of the nature of the environment there. Building infrastructure, for example, in an Arctic environment takes much longer, much more difficult than almost any other environment. You're absolutely correct to say that there's a long lead time. But do we absolutely have to monitor the security situation there as well? Yes. We do. Again, this crosses both political, military, diplomatic, and, you know, kind of the hard security realms. We do have to pay attention to that. I think we have historically, and I think we will continually, but we are also really emphasizing, and the point of this strategy really is to highlight our opportunity at this point to not just monitor and react, but really to be involved in shaping the outcome of this in a proactive manner so that we can, again, ideally preserve the more cooperative angles, aspects of our interactions in the Arctic and make that the predominant theme going forward.
Dr. Chu, what should Alaskans expect to see in a military presence in the next 5 to 10 years? How will the Department of Defense sort of ramp up to address traffic, territory, and security concerns in the Arctic?
So currently, certainly in the next 5 years or so, I don't anticipate any major changes in presence. As I said, from a security standpoint, we don't see major threats in the region in this particular time frame that necessitate changes in military presence. On the safety piece, in particular on environmental safety and human safety issues, we certainly will ensure that we are able to support our colleagues in the Coast Guard, for example. I would really caution you and listeners to remember to put this in perspective. Although we do see a lot of additional activity, everything from tourism to intra-regional commerce and exploration, we do have to put that in context. Certainly more people, but this is not yet kind of a vast opening of the Arctic.
We've heard a lot about the U.S. failure to sign onto the Law of the Sea Treaty. Does this impact the strategy militarily to not have the U.S. be a part of this treaty?
On the one hand, no. At an operational level, to be honest, we continue to operate and collaborate consistent with the norms laid out in the Law of the Sea Treaty on a day-to-day basis. That said, at a broader political level, and I'll defer to my colleagues in the State Department on this, the one concern I have about not being a part of the structure associated with the Law of the Sea Treaty is that there will be a lot of forums and discussions which we may not be able to participate in as effectively as we would like to if we are not signatories.
Daniel Chu is the Undersecretary for Defense Strategy at the Pentagon. A transcript of the full interview is online, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Democratic state lawmakers are introducing legislation in the House and Senate to expand Medicaid in Alaska. Governor Sean Parnell rejected the expansion, which is part of the Affordable Care Act, in November. The law calls for the federal government to pay for 100% of the expansion for the first 3 years. That match would gradually decrease to 90% by 2020. Senator Bill Willikowski, an Anchorage Democrat, says the governor's own Medicaid report shows the expansion would be a huge benefit to the state.
From better health care to Alaskans to new jobs to lower health insurance premiums for Alaskan businesses, making Medicaid make sense both financially and morally.
No Republican lawmakers have signed onto the legislation. Willikowski says he's hopeful that will change. Senator Berta Gardner, a Democrat from Anchorage, says she's going to keep working to win Republican support.
The folks I've talked with are theoretically supportive, but they want to take a wait-and-see approach. They're not willing to come out publicly at this point.
The bill expands Medicaid to childless adults who earn less than about $20,000 a year. The state would participate as long as the federal government pays at least 90% of the cost. Representative Lance Pruitt, an Anchorage Republican, says he wasn't approached by Democrats about the bill, but thinks the legislation is a no-go.
Are we really going to give something to someone? And we're going to write legislation that says, here you go, and if the feds do something, we're going to take it back.
26 states are expanding Medicaid this year, and several more are considering it. The Taku River Tlingit First Nation has filed suit in the Supreme Court of British Columbia to stop the Tulsiqua Chief Mine. The old mine is at the headwaters of Southeast Alaska's most prolific salmon stream. KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander reports.
In 2004, the Supreme Court of Canada ordered the British Columbia government to consult with the Taku River Tlingit First Nation on decisions surrounding the Tulsiqua Chief Mine. The Taku River watershed in northwestern BC and southeast Alaska is the Tlingit's traditional territory.
The consultation is an ongoing obligation.
Randy Christensen is a lawyer for EcoJustice Canada, the donor-funded environmental law firm handling the case. He says the obligation is clearly spelled out in the 2004 decision.
At the end of the day, the Supreme Court of Canada declared that our client was owed a duty of consultation and accommodation on this project.
At that time, Redfern Resources owned the mine. The company went bankrupt in 2009. Chieftain Metals picked up the property and environmental permits. In the current lawsuit, the Taku River Tlingit alleged they were never consulted about a government decision that the Tulsiqua was substantially started. Under BC environmental process, once a mine is approved, the owners have a limited amount of time to get mobilized. In this case, 10 years. Substantially started does not mean mining. Though Chieftain Metals says it's ready to mine the Tulsiqua, in reality, the company is still looking for financing. But in June 2012, the BC Environmental Assessment Office declared the mine was substantially started. Christensen says the First Nation wants the BC Supreme Court to declare the Chieftain Metals environmental permit has expired.
Without an environmental assessment certificate, they can't proceed with any on-the-ground construction of this project.
Such a declaration would void all the Tulsiqua permits.
My primary feeling is of relief.
Chantel Hart is a member of the Children of the Taku. The society is not party to the lawsuit, but members are all Tlingit from the Taku River watershed.
I'm glad that the lawsuit is now out because at least it's just another firm, very clear stance that shows that Taku River Tlingit people are not going to allow Chieftain into the territory.
Hart says Chieftain Metals has ignored her people. The transboundary group Rivers Without Borders says the same goes for the BC Ministry of Environment. Chris Zimmer is Alaska's spokesman for the international group.
The
clear implication here is that if this lawsuit is successful, the mine is dead in the water and will have to go back to environmental assessment because it can't proceed without that certificate.
Chieftain Metals did not return calls for this story. In its year-end financial report to the Ontario Securities Commission, the company acknowledged the lawsuit, stating only, quote, "The corporation believes the petition is without merit." In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
The Alaska Volcano Observatory upgraded the alert level at Chisaldin Volcano in the Aleutian Islands today after observing some unrest at the summit. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
AVO scientist Christy Wallace says the unusual activity at Chisaldin began yesterday.
A little bit ago, AVO changed the color code at Chisaldin from green to yellow based on increased temperatures at the summit crater of Chisaldin volcano, as well as increased steaming yesterday. Both of those observations were observed via satellite imagery.
Wallace says the observations don't mean Chisaldin is in imminent danger of eruption. The yellow status just indicates behavior that isn't normal. Chisaldin is on Unimak Island, about 100 miles northeast of Unalaska. It was last elevated to yellow in 2009, when the same kind of activity occurred. Wallace says that anomaly didn't result in anything more serious. Historically, though, Chisaldin has been very active.
It's erupted approximately 28 times since 1775, so in historic times it's erupted quite frequently, although the eruptions are usually low-level plumes in ash and steam plumes, so not a particularly dangerous volcano, although the eruption that occurred in 1999 did send ash plumes as high as 45,000 feet above sea level.
Wallace says the AVO was going to keep monitoring Chisaldin for signs of explosions, but the seismic stations closest to the summit aren't working right now. That means using more distant monitoring points as their main sources of data.
There's a whole network of stations, so we're just relying on other stations that are not quite as close to the summit area where we're seeing the activity, and you know, hopefully those will be enough for us to pick up a seismic signal, although this volcano is not just monitored with a seismic network. We're still using satellite imagery and then the infrasound stations, which are good at detecting explosion signals.
There are two other volcanoes in the Aleutians currently on a yellow alert. Those are Cleveland, 175 miles southwest of Unalaska, and Veniaminov, northeast of King Cove. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Platt. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Electronic health records free Alaskans from the paper chase by giving doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where they need it. Electronic health records increase safety and security. Electronic records take health information out of the filing cabinet and into the digital light. You can find out more at ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.